Welcome to Momentum Magnet, a podcast to inspire your growth. I'm Karen Morales, and your host in helping you find ways to make positive changes for your business, health, relationships, and life. We always have a path to a happier ending, so let's get started today. Hello and happy Friday. Welcome to Momentum Magnet. We are here every Friday giving you tips and tricks so that you can add more momentum to your life and business. Today, I have the unique pleasure of inviting Frank King to join us. We talked about having a TEDx speaker, and man, will he deliver. Not only has he been featured on TEDx, but he was a former writer for The Tonight Show for over 20 years. He's also fought a lifelong battle of depression, and he's had thoughts of suicide. And he's turned that long, sometimes dark journey into 5 TEDx talks, reaching all types of corporate, association, and college audiences. He uses his life lessons of all of the above, as well as the lessons learned crisscrossing the countries in the late 80s and 90s, doing shows on the road. I know this is going to be a great conversation. So welcome, Frank.
Oh, no, it's going to be horrible. Tune out now. It'll be an hour of your life you can't have back. Just go. Now, just one quick question. Is it audio only? Do I need to? Because I said to Karen, I didn't shave this morning. I got the Don Johnson sort of Miami Vice, you know, late 70s look.
You've got Don Johnson and I have wet hair. So you know what? We're a power couple right now.
Okay. But so some people can see us. But it's on video.
Some people can see us. So we've got to bring some reality back into the world that we're living in these days. I think people need to know that. Yeah, there might be some sweatpants going on.
Long as your pants. That's all I'm asking. Ask Jeffrey Toobin. your camera is on. Well, they teach you in radio. The first thing they teach you when you do radio, the microphone's always on. Even if it's off, it's on. Because there's always a chance of a hot mic incident where you say something and you assume it was on. I'm sorry, you assume the microphone was off and you say something and there goes your job. So I always assume
a new type of hot mic moment these days. It's the hot Zoom moment where you've decided to go surf the internet and you forget that you're still streaming live video. That happened to me the other day. I did not realize I was still on camera while I was doing something else. Not my best moment. You're putting on lipstick, eating, talking to someone else.
Oh, that'd make a great YouTube video. Watch this. She has no idea the camera's on.
But we are here to talk about more weighty things than lack of getting ready or ability to control ourselves during Zoom. The reason we invited you here today was first to talk about your journey to becoming a TEDx speaker, because it's something that comes up so often with my audience wanting to know how you become a speaker. But I think you actually have a way more important message than just the method to get there. And it's really the work you've done around depression and really being a suicide creator. So I think we should probably start there. I think this message is so time sensitive in these days.
Oh, you think?
Yeah, exactly. Yep. So why don't you talk a little bit about your journey and how you've made your message.
Yes. Oh yeah. People love to hear your messes and stresses than your successes. Yeah, that's what I tell my speaker coaching clients. Yeah, you know, all your success is great, but they want to hear the messes and stresses first and what you learned and then, you know, and then what you're going to teach them. And by the way, that's the format of a TED Talk. It's not just your story. The first third is generally your story, your journey, your heroine or hero's journey, all the struggles. Second part is, here's what I learned. Third part is, now, here's what I'm going to teach you, because most of the TEDx curation teams that select the speakers, that's the question they often ask at the audition after they see your idea. Well, that's a great idea. Okay, what are you going to teach our audience? So I make sure that all my speakers that I'm coaching have a list in front of them of 3 to 6 bullet points, learning objectives, able to's, how to's, action items, because that's what TED's all about. It's what can the TED audience do after they heard you speak they could not do before they heard you speak? So that's, I think, one of the two most important parts of a TEDx. The other most important part, and you mentioned this before we went on the air, is backstory.
Right.
The more interesting your backstory. I don't know if you ever watch America's Got Talent, but I watch those clips, just the clips on YouTube. And I noticed a pattern is a lot of the people who are auditioning or actually participate in the show have great backstories. He spent 35 years in jail, wrongly convicted, but, you know, he kept on singing and he's here today. You know, I'm going down, down, down and on fire. So with TEDx Talks, they are looking for, it is almost as important as what you're going to teach them as what your backstory is. And so,
and the more salacious, the better. Or what's the good filter for the backstory? The more awe-inspiring moments of.
Yeah, it's you know, my first TEDx. I was a comedian starting. You mentioned it on the road doing clubs for 2,629 nights in a row, 7 years and change. And I was on the road with comics. This is like mid-'80s to mid-'90s. I was on the road with. And back then, they put you up in a three-bedroom condo. They call it a comedy condo. And so not only do we work together, we, you know, we lived together for a week. And then we're Seinfeld and Adam Sandler and Kevin James, Rosie and Ellen and, you know, and on and on and on. And so that was that seven.
People in your condos or those? Yeah,
they were the people I was working with at the comedy club and come home to the condo, you know, pop a beer, watch the Letterman. So okay. Ron White, Jeff Foxworthy. All those guys, all the guys that were doing the road from 85 to about 95 during the comedy club boom.
Yep.
And then it busted and I got invited to do a radio show in my old hometown of Raleigh, North Carolina, the number one morning show in Raleigh. It was a rock station, the Yardy 106, the home of rock and roll. And I was able to take a number one morning show and drive it to number six in 18 months. A friend of mine said, you didn't just drive that into the ground. You drove it into Middle Earth. I'd always had a very clean act, so the comedy club thing was waning. I thought, I'll do corporate comedy. I'll speak on the rubber chicken circuit, you know, at association meetings after dinner, after lunch. And you make about 10 times as much money doing that as you do in clubs, because not everybody can do the corporate circuit because not everybody's clean. I had a very clean act, and so I did the corporate circuit for silly money till 2007 or 8 when the recession hit, and the business dropped off 80%. Right. And my wife and I lost everything we'd worked for in 25 years in a bankruptcy. And that's when I learned what the barrel of my gun tasted like. Spoiler alert, I didn't pull the trigger. A friend of mine came up to me after a keynote back in January. He'd never heard me say that out loud. I didn't pull the trigger. And he said this, hey, man, how come you didn't pull the trigger? I go, hey, man, could you try to sound slightly less disappointed? That's where the mental health comedian part comes in. Because people always ask me, a comedian talking about depression, thoughts of suicide, how in the heck does that work? Well, you know, the original comedian was a court jester. Court jester's job was to speak truth to power on behalf of the powerless. I believe I speak truth to the power of mental illness on behalf of those often powerless in its grip. I believe where there's humor, there is hope. Where there's laughter, there's life, that nobody dies laughing. And I have two mental illnesses. One is called major depressive disorder, better known as depression. It's not situational. I've been most depressed at some of the best times in my life. It's like a wheel with a flat spot. It just comes around. Okay. And most people who have that, their downtime lasts 3 days to 3 weeks. Mine happens to be 3 days. That's my cycle. And recurs. Just comes, you know, out of nowhere oftentimes. Now, I can be triggered by like by the bankruptcy, but generally it's not. It's not situational. That said, there are probably, I don't know, millions of people in the world right this minute because of the pandemic, social distancing and so forth that are situationally depressed. They've never been depressed before, but their world's been turned upside down. They have no more routine. You know, they don't commute to work anymore and come home at 5 o'clock when the whistle blows. So what worries me is they may not know why they can't get out of bed in the morning. If you've never been depressed, how would you know what it feels like? They're just lying in bed thinking, why can't I get out of bed? Why can't I drag myself to the shower and, you know, run a load of wash? That, by the way, is one way you can spot somebody who's depressed on Zoom. This is sort of, you know, COVID casual. But there's also...
That's a new dress code.
Yeah, COVID casual.
You're going to come in COVID casual? Thank you.
COVID casual. But let's say you log on to the Zoom and you notice their hair is a little dirty, their clothes aren't really that clean, and they're usually put together pretty well.
Right.
That may be an indication they're living with depression because they can't drag themselves to the shower and then run a little wash. So that's something to look out for. you know, your fellow, whoever you're working with on Zoom. Anyway, I've been doing podcast after podcast after podcast, teaching neuronormal people, neurotypical people who aren't normally depressed, how people with mental illness get through the day, get out of bed in the morning and move forward. Because I wake up in an uncertain world every day, whether there's a pandemic or not. So if you're high functioning, mentally ill, you have probably developed a self-care plan and some other techniques to achieve that. Like I said, I worry about people who are, you know, have never been depressed and wouldn't recognize it, and then can't. And hopefully after the podcast, they realize, oh, that's why I can't get out of bed and go run a load of wash and take a shower. I'm depressed. At which point I recommend they have a telemedicine appointment with a mental health provider and just find out, are you depressed? I mean, is it really depression? If so, then maybe medication for a short period of time. A little tip for your listeners on medication. Yeah. Most often the first medication, not always a good fit. I was talking to a guy about psychotropics, you know, the pharmacological products. And he said, Frank, here's the deal with say, antidepressants. A particular antidepressant, one third of the people who take it love it. One third, it's okay. One third, it's not working. So that's two thirds of the people where it's not really doing what it's supposed to be doing. They now have a cheek swab DNA test. They take your DNA from a cheek swab. They try to match it to the antidepressant or two they believe would work best with your metabolism. So you get a lot less of that. Go on, doesn't work, taper off. Go on, doesn't work, taper off. So it's
come on. Does that raise the efficacy, the cheek swab?
Yes. In other words, if it works, if they discover ones that'll work best with your particular DNA, then there's a better chance you'll be in that first group, that first third where it really works. Because see, the doctor only knows really what the drug salesman told him.
Right.
So
what about that causation or that linkage? And sometimes they can actually upregulate the suicidal tendencies with some of the drug interactions on certain people.
Yes. And it's not just interactions. Sometimes if somebody is so depressed, they can't get out of bed in the morning, and you give them antidepressants that work,
right,
they may actually be able to work up the gumption to attempt suicide. Yeah, that's, and some of them actually have as a side effect, ironically, of some antidepressants, suicide is a side effect. I would say that's not really a side effect, that's an effect. But, and there are, you know, I was on a supplement you can buy over the counter, you can buy it at Costco, called SAM-E. Mm-hmm. SAM-E, it's got a long chemical name.
Okay.
But if you go to Costco and you look for a box that says SAM-E, it's good on mild depression. And the only two side effects are it's good for your liver and it's good for your joints. I had a cat with chronic liver disease, and she got a kitty version of the SAM-E every morning, and she lived to be 14. Wow. So it's good for your liver. It's good for your joints. But it's age 60. My wife goes, oh, ask a doctor, see if he can give you something for that depression. So I asked my doctor and he wrote me a script, and I was in that first third. What he gave me and the amount he suggested works. 2 weeks in, my wife noticed a difference in my personality. 3 weeks in, I thought, what was I waiting for? Holy smoke. It doesn't make you giddy, but it does take the edge off. So that's, and if you're neuronormal and you're situationally depressed because of the pandemic, it's not a life sentence. They're not going to make you take antidepressants the rest of your life, just long enough to get over this hump, and you can taper off when the world goes back to near normal. So when I do that podcast, I try to dispel some of those myths about, you know, medication and depression and suicide. So what happened was, after my near suicide, the meeting planner said to me, Frank, we love you dearly. We can't pay you that kind of money just to be funny. You got to teach our audience something. And I thought, what in the world do I got to teach anybody? So I got a book from a friend. She wrote it. It's called The Message of You. And the subtitle is fabulous. Turn Your Life into a Money-Making Speaking Career. And it's almost a fill in the blank. She walks you through in the book, finding what she calls your heart story.
Okay.
The kind of thing that makes your heart sing, makes the hair on your arm stand up, your passion in a word. And about halfway through the book, I'm thinking I ain't got anything. And about two thirds of the way through the book, I thought, oh my God, I could talk about suicide prevention because of my history, my family history, my close call. So I got some training in suicide prevention because you have to give them takeaways, able to's, how to's, action items. So I teach people signs and symptoms of depression, signs and symptoms, thoughts of suicide, what to say, what not to say, what to do, what not to do, and resources, along with telling my personal story and give them a little humor along the way. So in 2014, I thought to myself, okay, now that's a great idea, Frank, but you're a comedian. Who is going to take you seriously? So my wife said, to rebrand, you should do a TED Talk. And I famously said, what's a TED Talk? Just by chance, there's an online speaker bureau called Speaker Match. And yeah. that week I got a lead on Speaker Match. Hey, would you like to be in our TEDx? Send an application. And it was in Vancouver, British Columbia, which is about 7 hours north of me. So I sent it in with an idea. And they called me and said, Frank, we have good news. We have bad news. I said, what's the good news? You're in. What's the bad news? You think the Vancouver in question is Vancouver, Washington, which is 2 hours from where you are. It's Vancouver, British Columbia. We're 7 hours, Frank. So I actually flew up to do the audition. I wanted to do it live. And they had me do, oftentimes they'll have you do 5 minutes, either an overview or 5 minutes of the actual talk. And I did 5 minutes of my actual talk. And then 10 minutes of Q&A. And they liked it enough that they had me do the TEDx. And so at age 56 in 2014, I came out on stage as depressed and suicidal. Nobody in my family knew. My wife didn't know. My friends didn't know. Because as a mentally ill person, I'm a great actor. I have a Screen Actors Guild card for a reason. And a lot of my mentally ill friends, many people don't know. I had somebody say to me, I don't know anybody who's mentally ill. I said, yes, you do. You just don't know they're mentally ill. It's like in the 70s, people used to go, I don't know anybody gay. Well, yes, you do. You just don't know that they're gay. So I came out on stage, and then when it posted on YouTube, my wife's about to hit play. And I said, hold it. I need to tell you about a half dozen things you don't know about me, and I don't want you to learn it on YouTube. I mean, she was floored. And that's one of the things I recommend is when you can come out to friends and family, people you love, know, and trust with that information, and build your support system. Because you need, it's like a car race. You need a pit crew in case the wheels come off. And so they need to know in advance where you are, where you've been and what might happen so they can help you. So I did the TEDx, that first one, and it started rebranding me because I was starting to send that out to event planners, meeting planners, speakers right. bureaus. And then from that one, I got two phone calls, one from New York, one from New Jersey, TEDx events. And they both said the same thing. Hey, I saw your TEDx. Do you have another mental health TEDx in you? I said, I have two. Which one do you want? So I did two more by invitation. The fourth one, I had to apply. It was called Suicide, the Secret of My Success, Dead Man Talking. And
how much do you have to change the theme now that you've done it so many times? I mean, it's always about suicide and mental health, but mm-hmm. how much does the story really deviate from your first onstage appearance?
The only common element in each one is my lived experience.
Right.
I say to the audience, look, here's the elephant in the room. You're wondering, a comedian talking about suicide? I talk about my grandmother's suicide, my mother found her, my great aunt suicide, my mother and I found her. I was 4 years old. I screamed for days, and my close call. And then I dive in to, and the one on Suicide, the Secret of My Success, I actually wrote for entrepreneurs mm-hmm. because I read two studies that said entrepreneurs, a third of them, are depressed and suicidal. And the conclusions by the clinicians were little sleep, long hours, and unmet expectations.
Okay.
And I believe that's the case for a lot of people. However, I believe there's a significant subset like me in that I'm not depressed and suicidal because I'm an entrepreneur. I became an entrepreneur because I was depressed and suicidal. I was married to the wrong woman, lovely woman, my high school and college sweetheart. We shouldn't have been together. I was selling insurance, which is what she wanted me to do. And it's a great business, but I hated it with a purple passion. And I was not going to open mic night at the Comedy Store, which is where I thought I belonged.
Right.
And I had the thought, I'm going to kill myself if I don't change something. My second thought was, well, wait a minute. I could divorce my wife, quit my job, try comedy. If it works, great. If it doesn't, hell, I can still kill myself. That's why suicide is the secret of my success. And like most mentally ill people, I thought that was just me. Nobody else in the world ever had those thoughts. I've since met at least a half a dozen people, entertainers, comedians, entrepreneurs, same basic thought process. They have a dream, but they're not pursuing it. They're in a job that they, you know, a good job, but they really don't like. They may be with someone who's a wonderful person, but just not for them. And so they become suicidal and they have the same conversation with themselves. Well, what have I got to lose? And bear in mind, I had nothing to lose by trying comedy. And there are a few things on the planet more powerful than somebody with absolutely nothing to lose. I could put it all on one roll of the dice. And if it came up craps, I'd go ahead and kill myself. Fortunately, I did my first open mic night. And about halfway through, inside my head, I heard, you're home. And I thought to myself, I'm going to do this for a living. I have no idea how. And then a year and a half later, I said to my girlfriend, now my wife of 33 years, I said, hey, look, I'm going on the road to be a stand-up comedian professionally. You want to come along? Figuring she'd go, oh, hell no. And she goes, yeah. So we gave up our jobs, our apartment, got in the car, and that's why we were on the road for 2,629 nights in a row. And have, you know, from our mid-20s to our mid-30s, with these amazingly intelligent, funny people, you know, traveling the country. It was an amazing time to be in the comedy business, and we had a ball. I mean, it wasn't easy. But just, I was pursuing my passion. I believed it was my purpose. And then when I decided to speak on suicide prevention, that, it makes my heart sing. It makes the hair on my arm stand up. Because I have another mental illness called chronic suicidal ideation. Oh. A lot more rare. What it means is, for people like me, people in my tribe, the option of suicide is always on the menu as a solution for problems large and small. And when I do my keynotes, I say, let me tell you how small. My car broke down a couple of years ago. I had three thoughts unbidden. One, get it fixed. Two, buy a new one. Three, I could just kill myself. That's chronic suicidal ideation. The upside of that is, every time I've spoken since 2014, except for once, there has been somebody in the audience, and sometimes more than one, who have chronic suicidal ideation. They did not know it had a name. They thought they were just some kind of freak because of the way their brain works. And all alone. I had a young woman come up to me after a college presentation. She goes, I want to thank you for your keynote. I said, you're welcome. She goes, but I got to tell you, it made me weep. How did it make you weep? She goes, you know the story about your car? Get it fixed, buy a new one, kill yourself. She goes, I've been having those thoughts all my life. I didn't know it had a name. I thought it was just me and I was completely alone, some kind of freak. And when I heard you say that out loud, I realized for the first time in my life that I'm not, in fact, alone, and I wept.
Is that becoming more pervasive with those suicide thoughts going into younger audiences? Because I've heard more and more parents identifying very young children having a stressful moment, and not something as traumatic as your situation with your great aunt, but, you know, I lost my homework, or, you know, my toy broke, and saying things like that. And I think for a lot of people that haven't had those tendencies in their life, you don't know how to receive it.
Are you serious? Are you really talking about killing yourself?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's what you're looking for is a pattern, not just one, I'm going to kill myself.
Right.
You know, I lost my dog, gave my homework, I'm going to kill myself. You're looking for a pattern of behavior. Here's the thing. 8 out of 10 people who are suicidal, I mean, all the way down to young people, are ambivalent. They're not sure they want to do it. And 9 out of 10 in the last 7 days leading up to an attempt give hints, verbal, nonverbal, physical, behavioral, whatever, which means they want somebody to intervene. So if 8 out of 10 are ambivalent and 9 out of 10 give hints, that tells me that the vast majority of people want somebody to spot the signs and to step in. And that's what I teach, is how to spot it, how to know when they're serious, and how to step in, what to say, what not to say. And oftentimes it's more what you shouldn't say.
So
for
tell
example.
me, what do you do? Yeah, give us some examples.
Okay. You don't say, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Turn that frown upside down. Have you tried fish oil? Can't tell you how many times. My uncle, he tried fish oil. He got off all his antidepressants. Yeah, well, I wouldn't. I think I'd lock my bedroom door and I slept at his house just in case. By the way, let me give you three symptoms of depression. We talked about letting your personal hygiene go. That's a very obvious one. There's also has trouble getting
that
started.
That can also be a symptom of coronavirus. So I think that
yeah,
letting your personal hygiene go.
Yeah.
We take that down a notch this day and age.
Yeah, because you can't smell them over Zoom.
I'm identifying with that one, but I don't know. I haven't had suicidal tendencies.
Yeah, so again, you have to eat. What you're looking for is a pattern of things.
Okay.
Okay, yeah, their personal hygiene's going, and you notice their clothes are a little dirty. So there's two clues, not one.
Okay.
But they could just be lazy and don't want to run over to watch. Or they thought the podcast was audio. Well, eat too much, can't eat, sleep too much, can't sleep. Either one of those are signs of depression. And, you know, has trouble getting out of bed in the morning, rallies in the afternoon. Let's say you're doing a Zoom and you're wherever you work, you're doing a Zoom every so often. And they've always been in the morning and the person's always late. But you flipped it to 3 p.m. and when you log on, they're there. So obviously having trouble getting up in the morning, but rallying in the afternoon. Now, what do you say to somebody who you believe is depressed? You say, I'm here for you. And I mean it. I know you're not lazy, crazy, or self-absorbed. I know that depression is a mental illness. Now, here's the good news. With time and treatment, it will get better. I will take the time. I'll help you get the treatment. Now, here's the biggie. You have to ask them this question. If you can't ask it, you find somebody who can. Are you having thoughts of suicide? Just like that. And there's an old urban legend that you should never mention the S word in front of somebody who's depressed. And as a comedian, I love the reasoning. It might give them the idea. Suicide? What a great idea. Why didn't I think of that? Trust me, it's crossed their mind. You have to ask them flat out, are you having thoughts of suicide? Now, let's say you still believe in your gut. Something's telling you they are having thoughts. And we'll go over the signs and symptoms of thoughts of suicide in a second. But they're not forthcoming. They don't tell you. You know, how would you know? Well, here's the signs. They talk about death and dying quite a bit. You catch them Googling death and dying. Death and dying appears as a theme in their artwork, their music, their writing, their comedy. They're getting their affairs in order. And here's a very dangerous part of that. They're giving away prized possessions. So, because they want to make sure they go to the people they want them to go to when they're gone. And if they give away a pet, that's the top of the pyramid in terms of giving away pride because they want to make sure the animal's taken care of. Of course, an obvious sign is stockpiling medication or buying a gun. Here's one that's counterintuitive, extremely dangerous. They've been depressed forever, and then for some reason you can't figure out they're no longer depressed. They're happy beyond measure. And of course, you're happy and relieved because they're happy. Well, here's the problem. They may be happy because they've chosen time, place, and method. And they know the pain is finite. It's going to end. Because another myth about suicide, why did so-and-so want to kill himself? Well, chances are he didn't want to kill himself. There's a better than even chance. All he wanted to do was simply end the pain. So, but see, if they're happy, you're going to be happy. And so that's very dangerous because, you know, but again, what you're looking for is a series of symptoms, a series of, you know, saying things, you know, after this weekend, you know, they won't have to worry about me anymore. Again, a little dangerous because you're thinking, well, you're going to move, you're going to change jobs. Well, you know, why wouldn't they be worried about it? And there's something called passive suicidality. You hear people say this, I would never die by suicide, never take my own life. But if I didn't wake up tomorrow morning, that wouldn't bother me. That's passive. And you hear a lot of children say, when I was a child and suffering trauma, I would go to bed at night and pray to God to take me during the night. They weren't going to actively, you know, attempt, but they wouldn't be upset if you know, God took them. Yeah. So, okay. Now, let's say they are forthcoming. I am having thoughts of suicide. What are you going to say? Well, you say, do you have a plan? And if you have a plan, what is your plan? And if it's detailed, time, place, method, you need to get them on the phone with the Suicide Prevention Lifeline. And if they won't pick up the phone, you pick up the phone, call the lifeline. The volunteer will do what they can to get the phone in the hand of the person who's in crisis to benefit younger people nowadays, because younger people are more forthcoming in text. They created a suicide prevention text line. You text the word help to 741-741. And it'd be somebody roughly your same age on the other end texting back. So at 741-741, text the word help. Now, let's say that they are suicidal, having thoughts. They have a plan, but it's not particularly well formed. It's kind of nebulous. And by the way, what I'm about to tell you is not in any textbook anywhere. A psychiatrist and I came up with this. Another guy who suffers chronic suicidal ideation. We're chatting back and forth about it. Let's say the plan is not that detailed. What do you do? Well, he and I agreed that the thing to do was to go, are you going to kill yourself? And if they say no, and I believe this is the most important question, okay, if you're not going to kill yourself, tell me why not. Make them give voice to whatever it is. And if you ask me that, one of the reasons I'm still here, you know the story I told you about the young woman from college who thought she was a freak, and then when I revealed I have chronic suicidal ideation, she wept because she realized she wasn't alone. And it's happened over and over and over and over. I realized one night, I was in Billings, Montana. It was dusk. I was in a college. A kid was going to get the car to take me back to my motel. And it started to snow. And I could hear a river in the distance. And it hit me. I am sort of like George Bailey in the movie, It's a Wonderful Life. I've been shown what all these people's lives would be like if I weren't there to speak and to reassure them that they are not, in fact, alone. So, like George Bailey, if I kill myself, all those people that would have heard me speak and I would have reassured them, I would be taking all those people with me because, hopefully I've steered them far enough off the path of suicide by letting them know they're not alone, that they'll live a normal life. But if I weren't there,
It would
perhaps
be.
it would end in a suicide. So a friend of mine said, you can't live with that. I go, no, I can't die with that. I'm not going to take them with me. I couldn't. So I'm stuck. Okay. Unfortunately.
It's the driving force for most people that get on stage and bear really personal stories. I mean, you do it because that one person comes up to you after the speaking engagement and tells you what you said mattered, what you
Yes.
said is. Sat with me, what you said is what I needed to hear today. And whether that is about, relationships, life, health, business, or even something as deep as suicide, it matters to share your story.
Well, and sometimes there's one or two people. I tell speakers who are going to work in the mental health space, if you're on stage and you're being vulnerable, which I believe is a superpower, Brené Brown, I got that from Brené Brown. She goes, vulnerability is a superpower.
Knows what she's talking about, that Brene.
Yeah. Because, it's just for a guy to get up and talk about emotional things, because guys, I grew up in the South and the big boys don't cry was the, motto for guys. It's called toxic masculinity. Don't seek help. Don't cry. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. But to see me on stage, I get a little choked up and tell my story. And sometimes there's two people and sometimes there's eight people lined up. And not just because they have chronic suicidal ideation, they have a story they want to tell. What I discovered when I was preparing for my first TEDx, even though one person dies by suicide in the US every 9 minutes, hardly anybody talks about it unless you bring it up. And dear Lord, everybody's got a story about themselves, about a loved one, about a friend. I was at my fourth TEDx and I was in the first flight of speakers. And one of the other speakers said to me, you're going to leave when you get done. I go, I can't leave. Why can't you leave? I said, when we break after the fourth speaker and, for cookies and lemonade, watch what happens. And sure enough, I get up there. There are eight people lined up
Right.
to talk to me. Two of the people, mother and daughter, were in Pensacola where the TEDx was. They were on vacation. They typed into Google things to do in Pensacola. Up comes the TEDx. And there's my name and the mental health comedian suicide prevention. They paid $95 a piece for tickets because Her brother was terribly depressed and moved in with her 3 months ago and seemed to be getting better. And then she came home one day and he'd taken his own life. And so she wanted to know, you know, because I have gotten close, stared into the abyss and come back. She wanted to know why, what was the difference? How did I end up coming back and he did not? And she said, why would he want to kill himself? And I said, I'm not sure this is any comfort to you, but chances are he didn't want to kill himself. He simply wanted to end the pain. And then she said, well, what about all the people he left behind, the pain they have? It's very selfish. And I said, well, on the outside looking in, it appears very selfish. Didn't you think about the people you're going to leave behind? Ironically, one of the three legs on a three-legged stool of suicidality is something called burdensomeness. You firmly believe that the world would be better off without you. So from the inside looking out, although irrational, it's a selfless act. When I was getting ready to kill myself, we were financially ruined. I had $1 million life insurance policy. So my wife would be brokenhearted, but she would be far from broke. So I felt like I was, you know, worth more dead than alive. And I was. I felt like a burden, and she would be better off. Even though I'd be gone, she could be restored financially and not have to worry because she was devastated. So fortunately, I didn't. And people go, how come you didn't? Well, the $1 million life insurance policy has a 2-year suicide clause. You kill yourself in the first 2 years, pays nothing. You wait 2 years and a day, $1 million. And I'd had the policy for 22 months. So I had to wait 2 months and a day to kill myself. Now, because I have chronic suicidal ideation, I'm willing to do it any time. I thought I can go 2 months because I knew 2 months and a day, pain ends. To this day, one of the things that keeps me alive is because I'm willing to kill myself at any moment, I can stand a great deal of pain knowing that I can end the pain at any moment that I choose. So ironically, my suicidality keeps me alive because I know there's a way to end the pain. And I, even though I'm suicidal, this chronic suicidal ideation, I've got a great life. I do what I love for a living. My lovely wife for 33 years, got wonderful animals. I said to somebody, I'm probably the most positive suicidal person you'll ever meet.
You strike me that way. Strike me that way.
Yeah.
Do you still have those cycles of staying in bed for 3 days?
No, but I do have a 3-day cycle. I can feel myself being pulled down. People ask me, what's that like? You know what it's like? It's like somebody's slowly turning up the force of gravity. And it gets harder and harder to put one foot in front of the other. Day two, I kind of flatten out at the bottom. And day three, I can feel myself coming back up as if somebody's turning down the force of gravity. And the benefit of knowing my cycle is this. When someone is wretchedly depressed, and if they're not aware there's a cycle that this will end at some point, they tend to live in the immediate. And they say to themselves, I'm in such pain and it's not ever going to get any better than it is at this moment. And that's very dangerous because that's when they think, what the heck, and take their lives. Now, I know when I start to cycle down, just hang in there for 3 days and I'll cycle back up. You know, it's going to be an ugly weekend. And let me tell you my techniques, if you'd like my...
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, this is something that neuronormal people don't do, but mentally ill people do every day. The simile that I use to illustrate this. There's a Greek character named Sisyphus, and he gave fire to man. That was his big crime, which I'm delighted because I love barbecue. But the gods were mad, and so they thought, what are we going to do to punish this jackass? So they said, I know. We'll have him roll a rock up a hill every day and tell him if he can get the rock over the hill, he can quit and go home. But of course, every time he got the rock near the top of the hill, it rolled back down to the bottom. So he had to start again the next morning. That's what having a mental illness is like, whether there's a pandemic or not. It's like every morning you wake up, there's a rock and a hill. Some days the rock is small and the hill's not so steep. Some days the rock is a boulder and the hill is Kilimanjaro. But every day, day in, day out, there's always a rock and a hill. And it's, you know, and it's your job to move the rock. And I tell people, my job, anybody who hears my voice, my job is to make sure when they wake up the next morning, they can still move that rock. So here's what I do for my self-care plan. Five things. One, diet. I'm on the keto diet and I do intermittent fasting. Two, diet, exercise. Behind this green screen, I've got an old Nordic track. I got some perfect push-ups, stretchy bands, you know, and I walk the dogs in the first half mile uphill every day. So diet, exercise, good night's sleep is restorative. Meditation, meditate twice a day. I have a little guided meditation called the Catnapper. I've been doing it for decades. It's great. It takes you down, brings you back up at the end. You will awake refreshed. 29 minutes tops. And then the last one is medication. And we talked about I'm on medication. A lot of people are foursquare against it. It's just the pharmaceutical companies trying to make a dollar. But, you know, if you get the right medication in the right dose, it can make a difference, a big difference. Life will get better. Perfect? No. Side effects? Yes. Difficult to dial in, you know, the medications, but now with the DNA cheek swab, a little easier. The second thing I do is called gamification. You make a game out of whatever it is you want to do. And probably the best example is can't drag myself out of bed in the morning. So I make a list of six things, a to-do list. And the game is, as soon as I scratch off number six, I can crawl back into bed. I can pull the covers over my head. I can binge watch the second season of The Mandalorian on Disney Plus. I don't care if it's 3 in the afternoon, broad daylight. I won, so I get to go back to bed. The idea is that the game gets you moving forward.
Right.
That's and forward motion is not a panacea, but it is.
It's momentum. Momentum always helps.
Yeah, forward momentum and action and, you know, and looking forward to, okay, well, I scratch off number six, I get to go back to bed. The way I get to the gym, which is 25 minutes away when you can go to the gym, is if I get to the gym and get inside and I'm all dressed out, all I have to do is one rep of one exercise, one bicep curl, I can turn around and go home because I won, because I got there. I've never done that. Although the last engagement I did, I flew to Chicago. There's a nice Hilton hotel. They had a wonderful gym downstairs. I love the elliptical runner. So I flew all day, got there 6 o'clock. And I thought, I'll go do the elliptical runner. I got on that thing and I started and I thought, you know, all I want to do is go to bed. So I realized I'm at the gym. I've done a minute on the elliptical runner.
You're going to go to bed.
All right. Done. See you guys in the morning. Smell you later. And the next morning I got in an hour. But it was that gamification because I made the effort to go downstairs in my outfit and get on that machine and do it for a minute. I win. I get to go back to bed. So the last leg of that three-legged stool, self-care, gamification, they ask a guy who was in the space station for a year, pretty much by himself, except when they brought groceries up. How do you handle that kind of social isolation? He said one word, routine. It's all about controlling the things you can control. I can control my diet. I can control my exercise. I can control when I go to bed. He said, you need a routine, especially now, because pretty much everybody's routine's been thrown completely out the window. He said, I go to bed the same time every night. I get up roughly the same time every morning. I have my meals roughly the same time. I exercise roughly the same time. I binge watch, you know, the third season of Ozark on Netflix same time. So he said, it's just a routine I'm in. I said, you have to have a routine because you're controlling the things you can control. So self-care plan, gamification, routine are the three things I teach people. How to survive a pandemic like a mentally ill person survives every day. And for some neuronormal people, this comes as a revelation, you know, because they're at loose ends. They have no idea maybe A, what they have, B, what to do about it. And here, you know, this is a way to begin to take control back because the 9/11 happened on one day, started rebuilding the next. The last recession happened over a week, 10 days, began to rebuild. This thing, you know, there's surge and then this and Thanksgiving and this and Christmas and this new strain. A friend of mine said, let me give you a kind of a comparison. He goes, if I asked you to run 20 miles, could you do it? I go, yeah, not in record time, but I could probably pull it off. He goes, you know why you could pull it off? Because at mile 15, you're thinking to yourself, oh, man, just 5 more miles. But if I said to you, Frank, run. Okay, how far am I going? Don't know. When can I stop? Not real sure. I'm not going to be quite as excited to strap on the Nikes and head out the door because we have no idea when.
Coming. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think the uncertainty of it all, the social distancing, the uncertainty, the stress and strain. You know, I go to the grocery store, there's some idiot there with a mask on that's not covering his nose. You know,
like, yeah. Oh. The beard mask.
I take pictures and I post them on Facebook because every time I go to the local grocery store, somebody has got the, you know, got it down here like that. I actually bought a t-shirt that says the mask is supposed to cover the nose. I don't want to say anything because, you know, they might be armed. I don't want to, you know, start trouble. But yeah, even if you don't think it's important for you, how about for me? People right. catch it. People catch it from asymptomatic people all the time. And these latest strains are like 70% more infectious. So, matter of fact, I read an article online this morning that said, do you go into town once a week, buy groceries and such? You might want to rethink that. They're suggesting that you either use Walmart or Whole Foods or one of the other services that deliver and have them put it on your front porch. Don't leave. Don't go downtown because of the variants, the new strains coming out. So yeah,
it's a tough world that we've been living in. So if somebody's listening to this today and they want to reach out to you and hear more about the help you offer for people struggling with suicide or depression, or even more so, you sparked this idea in them that they have a story inside.
Okay.
And share.
Let's talk about this. I would recommend buying the book called Talk Like Ted by Carmine Gallo, like the wine, G-A-L-L-O. What he did is he watched 500-600 TEDx talks, and he came up with a list of 9 things he believes are in every great TEDx. And when I design my TEDx, I design them using those 9, you know. And number one, surprise, surprise, passion for your topic.
Right.
Yeah. And
kind of important.
Yeah. And he also believes there should be a surprise, an aha moment, a moment when the audience sucks in their breath. When I did my first one, my grandmother left a suicide note. So I put the suicide note up on the screen in PowerPoint. Now they're looking at that note and the audience is thinking one of two things. I'm going to read it to them or they're going to read it. And a friend of mine who's a voiceover actress in LA recorded it for me. So I put it up, I wait a beat, and out of the darkness in this theater comes the voice of my grandmother from the grave. My dear children, I'm so sorry to leave you, but it can't be helped. You could almost hear the goosebumps popping in the audience when, you know, that voice came out of the darkness. So that's one of the things Carmine says is have a surprise for the audience somewhere in there. They don't make it easy to find the links to apply for TED Talks. If you go to a TED.com event site, there's no link on there for that event. Here's an easy way. Type in your Google search box, TEDx applications 2021. And if you do that, I did this yesterday when I was speaking to a group in Hawaii last night, talking about getting a TED talk. When I did that last night, there were 3 or 4 on that first page where the window for application is still open. You click on what you're looking for, by the way, is not a TEDx.com/event. You're looking for TEDxNashville.com, TEDxEmory.com. You're looking for .com because that's where you'll find the link to apply. So that's a really easy way to now, if there's not a .com, the organizers are always listed, but they never give email addresses to get hold of the organizers. Copy and paste their name into LinkedIn and see if you can DM them from LinkedIn or Facebook, the organizers. Let's say you find a link for TEDx Emory and you fill it out. You need to be very creative with your title, subtitle, or whatever they ask you to put in those first boxes. Because, for example, TEDx Seattle, they get 600 applications every event. Wow. So whatever you put in that first couple of boxes needs to grab them by the lapels and not let go. Because they're not looking for a reason to have you audition. If they got 600 to go through, they're looking for the first reason to throw you in the no pile.
For sure.
And the number one reason they do that is too much. You have too many ideas, or you're description of the idea is too broad, or because they normally ask you for a title, subtitle, or 10-word elevator pitch, which, by the way, my last one, my fifth one, my title and subtitle I used as an elevator pitch, and the title was Mental Health and the Orgasm: Treat Your Depression Single-Handedly. And it was so good that they called me and said, I said, do you want me to audition? They go, no, you don't have to audition. You're on. Which told me that that's the first mountain to climb, is getting their attention in the application. Now, a little tip for people, if you go to the first page of Google, TEDx applications 2021, and you find one, you may see this verbiage: who do you want to nominate? Well, that threw me the first time. I'm thinking, I want to nominate me. You can always nominate yourself, so don't let that throw you. And they'll ask you, are you willing to work with a coach? Yes. Are you willing to attend, organizational meetings by Zoom? Yes. I always just check it, yes, to all the boxes. Whatever they ask, I yes. And now you don't get paid to do a TEDx, but you don't pay to do it either. But you have to get yourself there and back. So, and it's good for speakers to help move your career forward. It's not going to get you a booking, I don't think, but it doesn't hurt to help get a booking, to have those big red letters behind you. You've obviously been vetted by the curation team at that TEDx event. Somebody else said you're good. And it makes a great demo clip for your website or whatever. And I teach my clients, the TEDx goes up on the TEDx Nashville YouTube channel. So you really don't have control of it. But what you can do is, I've got some software that was free that I can grab that URL and download the entire thing, the TED Talk. Now, I can't post the entire thing on my YouTube page, because then you get a little nasty gram. Frank, we noticed you published the entire talk. What you can do is drop it in some, video editing software, slice and dice it into a nice little sizzle reel, 3 to 5 minutes. And that's fine, as long as it's not the original version. So it's good for speakers. It's good for authors. If you've written a book, you can't pitch your book from the stage, but you can talk about the theme of the book and what they're going to learn in the book. If you got a particular charitable cause that you're, like global warming or whatever, you can't pitch for volunteers and donations, but you can talk about all the great work you do and the foundation does, and hopefully that will generate volunteers and donations, or perhaps other speaking gigs. We'd really love to have you come and speak for.
So I'm getting a text message right now of people saying, so how do I reach out to Frank? Because I want to be coached on how to write my TEDx.
That's right. Well,
How do
I'm in the Witness Protection Program. So I said it was in Oregon, but that's not really true.
that?
No. If you go to yourtedxcoach.com, and I assume you'll put that
It'll be in the
in,
show notes.
yeah, my phone number I'll send you as well. By the way, the phone number you're welcome to publish in the show notes, and here's why. When I do a talk on mental health, I say to the people, look, if you're suicidal, call the Lifeline. If you have mental illness and you're just having a really bad day, call a crazy person. And I pointed my phone number, because I'm not going to be judgmental. You don't have to explain anything to me. I'm just going to co-sign whatever nonsense you're going through.
Got it.
So, but you could also call me about doing TEDx. Yourtedxcoach.com. Now, when you go there's a free PDF. And when I did I spoke to the Hawaii Speakers Association last night, and I used that PDF. And what the PDF is, it's the six things you can do to kill your chances of landing a TEDx talk. Everybody tells you what you can do, but remember I said
It's
Seattle.
always more helpful to know what you can't do.
Yeah,
It's, yep.
because if it's Seattle and they got 600 applications, they're looking for the first reason to throw you in the no pile, because they got 599 more to go. For example, you need to follow the directions on the application to the letter.
You have 90 seconds, so give us your phone number quickly because we're going to cut.
858-405-5653. That's 858-405-5653. Goodbye, every morning.
Perfect, everyone. I could talk to Frank King for hours. I'm sure you could too. You could go over to YouTube and capture one of his full-length TED Talks, and you can Google him to learn more. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's been such a pleasure to hear about how we can get our messages out into the world and bring them to life in the TEDx venue. It's also a really important thing to ground ourselves in how to help people that we love or people that we work with during this hard time that could be struggling with suicidal tendencies. So I really do appreciate Frank's guidance and that message on mental health and healing. We are here every week at Momentum Magnet talking to leaders in the world so you can make better momentum in your life and business. Thank you so much and good night.
Thank you for listening to Momentum Magnet. We're here every Friday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time to share inspiring comeback stories. We want to hear your reviews and love getting your subscriptions on iTunes and Spotify. For show notes and past episodes, visit MomentumMagnet.com. I'm Karen Morales, keynote speaker, writer, and founder and CEO of Marketing Magnet, a fast-growing marketing agency for purpose-driven companies. Whether you are a business needing an agency or if you are looking for weekly tips to get ahead, sign up at marketing-magnet.com to receive our weekly inspiration on getting more in your life and business.